Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to Deep Thoughts. Man, I guess this season 5 is going to be like 80% at night. I might get a little bit more daytime action here in December because one of my writing projects is in a little holding pattern while I wait for some feedback. I'm going to start a new movie, though, on my own, which I've been working on the back of my head for a few months. I thought today we talk about alien gene splicing. I'm going to smoke this little Ashton here. Nice little stick. Quality company. Pretty damn good taste in New World cigar. All right. Big ass label on this little tiny, look at this big label on here. It's like 40% of the stick is covered by the band. It's cool. Okay, so I think you guys know I love the subject of aliens in general because I feel like, you know, what we have discussed in this world about aliens, it's always some, again, I'll lean back on my old phrase, unexplained science. You can watch a one-hour documentary on Discovery or the Sci-Fi Channel, you know, regarding theories about aliens splicing us together. And they don't really consult doctors and scientists regarding the requirements to do such a thing. And I'm no gene splicing guy myself, but I think that there are methods of definitely looking at some of the science that's fairly above board. Not stuff that people probably know offhand. But, you know, there's probably several ways to do this sort of thing. And there's always a reason for doing something, right? Why would an alien race come here and splice into perhaps the indigenous beings on this planet and create Homo sapiens sapien? Or just all these other amazing beings that we have on this planet? You know, for me, I've said it 1,000 times on the show. You guys are probably tired of me saying it, but for me, when I look at pretty much any of the life on this planet, you know, I'm looking at amazing creations, you know, from everything, the insects to the everything, fish, animals, everything is majestic and amazing. And I think with the internet, we are finally starting to appreciate animals a lot more than we ever did in the past. You know, Trump just signed this executive order making the penalties for being cruel to animals where they should be. You know, at least it's a good start. And, you know, it's interesting that anyone that would ever hurt an animal, you know, really with the objective of creating pain is someone who is completely off base as a human being. And so I'm glad that through, you know, millions and millions and millions of videos on all the social media sources, people are starting to find out, well, yeah, you know, these are beings that if we're going to especially attempt to domesticate several of them, we need to rethink what they are. Now, there's obviously a lot of folks that domesticate wild animals and they end up getting eaten by them. And I think there's some wisdom that can be harvested from those experiences as well. But gene splicing. Well, where are the touch points where gene splicing is generally thrown into the mix as a possibility? Well, like I said, you might look at, you know, again, there's just some exotic insects. I mean, insects for me are the most phenomenal because they're teeny tiny things, literally, and they have brains, and their brains are very smart, and they have all kinds of wild instinctual rituals that they go through, the mating rituals of birds. I mean, come on. The male bird's doing a little dance, the little fish that creates the beautiful diagram in the sand by just sucking the sand in his mouth and blowing it out and blowing out water. And he creates a perfectly symmetrical, beautiful concentric circle thing. I mean, it's just phenomenal. I mean, the little guy's, he's got an instinct to procreate. And, you know, in most beings out there, other than human beings, we have, well, those wild non-humans, basically, they copulate extremely fast, right? So it's not, I mean, I'm sure they, you, I've seen a tiger get really tired right after the magic moment, which I think is hilarious that everything gets tired right after that moment, you know, at least the guys do. But there's two real touch points in my brain for alien splicing Homo sapiens sapien into existence. There's the missing link, which last time I did my big anthropological dig and watched lecture after lecture on it, some conspiratorial that went off into Bigfoot things, hominid worshiping, but a lot of them were just lectures, just medical lectures about it, or anthropological lectures that are more medically based without any conspiracy attached to them. There's far more of those out there. But the missing link is about 150 million years, you know, if you believe all their dating. Well, the more that that chasm, you know, expands, it's more mind-blowing. The other gene-splicing stories that come about are stories that are very similar to, like, your Planet X theories, where an alien race comes to, you know, Earth. And what's funny, they come to Earth in an extremely short window of opportunity, with at least that theory, with their planets, you know, careening through the universe, and it's going to take, you know, I mean, at most, if they were traveling at least 60,000 miles per hour in space relative to our sun, they would only be available to really travel to our planet and for maybe, what, 6 months, a year? And, you know, that's not enough to gestate a human being to anything other than an infant, you know, and I really highly doubt that they've use some, we're going to get into all this stuff, but this, you know, some super accelerating thing to see what they had, you know, there's just not enough time. They'd have to be in space and be touching us for millions of years, stop by, you know, and they'd have to, you know, jump off their planet and then wait for the next epoch of this, this loop that this, you know, star Nemesis with Nibiru, come up, it's all hokey crap, but whatever. But splicing, when you take the conspiracy theories out of it for, you know, crazy stories like Planet X, and just look at it from an interstellar exploratory theory, or for some of you, maybe interdimensional, and for some of you, maybe, you know, if this is a dome of some sort, and we're going to talk about this. I interviewed my geologist today for an hour about her experiences in Antarctica, because she went there for a little shy of a month, but it took her 3 months to do the month there, basically, because you go to camp after camp and you keep getting, you know, prepped and trained to do what you need to do. So let's just look at the theory in general. Because the theory in general, if it makes anyone roll their eyes, I don't understand. Maybe rolling your eyes Planet X because of the logistics of their other half of the story, which no one ever looks at the logistics of it. But let's just go back to an Earth that maybe has naturally evolved a hominid, a two-legged, two-armed biped that is like a big giant thing and has a smaller brain cavity, that doesn't have articulated skull and, you know, nasal passages, so it can't speak in syllables. And so they need to refine it and get it to be more like them, which is capable of speaking and developing a really intense IQ, and thus become the tool makers that the Homo sapiens sapiens are known for. Here's the kicker for anyone who has doubts that that would be something that would happen on our planet. If we were to survive our own greed and finally get rid of these deep state, you know, bankers and oligarchies and monarchies on Earth, and find a way to operate in a way that economically we don't starve people and all that kind of stuff. We can get past this and become like the Gene Roddenberry world. Go see my episode on Star Trek for a whole breakdown of that beautiful universe. Then we would get into this realm where a lot of us live who watch this show, and definitely me making the show, where you're just creating 24/7. That's what you're doing. Okay, so then we start, you know, if there's space exists, if the universe exists as we believe it to be, and there's a bunch of planets out there and other galaxies, then we could go to them. And if we can get to them in a reasonable amount of time, and we figure out a way to accomplish all these things. We come up with, you know, ethereal gravity engines. We maybe figure out a way to travel faster than the speed of light with no problem. Perhaps there's some, you know, folding space technology, hyperspace, or whatever. We can get there quickly. Then we can start surveying the entire universe, just like we surveyed the planet of Earth and all of its continents and islands. And we would most likely find, although very difficult, I'm sure, an M-class planet like Earth, like Gaia. We as human beings have probably no problem conceiving of finding a planet. And, you know, we're in a different frame of mind now. We're not necessarily in a first contact situation because there wouldn't be necessarily an intelligent, like really like a human sentient speaking written language shelter, burial ritual sort of society down there. And then we would go, okay, this is right for domination. It makes an oxygenated atmosphere. The gravity is very similar to human beings. Maybe it's a little heavier, a little lighter, whatever. And at the same time, in a parallel track of space exploration technology, we would most likely continue to advance. And I think it's already been accomplished. All of the medical procedures and scientific discoveries to bridge automatically species barriers between us and whatever's down there, such that when we introduce our DNA, it's not rejected, it's accepted, and then it starts to splice together. For me, I think the species barrier is phenomenal. Just the concept of a species barrier, it really makes, I think, very little mathematical sense when it comes to evolution, you know. And they do splice, you know, or they don't splice. They mix a lion and a tiger together and they get this gigantic thing. They've mixed, you know, zebras with other animals of similar species. And a lot of times the reproductive organs fail to properly create themselves. But there's a lot of myths about these animals not being able to procreate. And they can. It's strange, right? So we've seen within our species on Earth being able to do this. But isn't it interesting that if you were to inseminate a elephant with a chihuahua, it won't work? It's interesting. And it's more than just the microscopic compatibility of a sperm and an egg. It is truly a genetic barrier that says, you're not like me enough for me to know how to bring our two DNA sequences together. So nothing conceives, nothing is created. Now, it's probably a really good thing, because in some areas of the world, we'd have goat people. But, you know, what if you figured it out? What would it take to figure it out? Well, there's tremendous misconceptions about how the human body works in general on planet Earth, which really prevents anyone from having the conversation for that long. Now, the species barrier thing, I just want to go into that a little bit, because I think most of us in the red pill world, we understand that there have been laboratories after laboratory after laboratory all around the world. Every major country that you can name has done this. As unethical as it might sound, they have spliced all kinds of weird stuff together. And there's been a lot of declassified things admitted to, right? Spiders, insects, linked in with animals. Gene splicing. I think that for the purposes of what we're talking about, the level of ingenuity would have to be extremely controlled and refined prior to the experiments taking place. Whereas human beings are kind of going, well, let's just see what happens. You know, let's put a spider with a pig, you know, and somehow they get that to work. Now, there's this, there's two techniques that I understand that could possibly be done. One, you've heard about gene splicing, and that is to take an embryo and start playing with its DNA before it ever develops in anything, and then you can put random, you know, nucleic acid sequences into DNA such that it will start replicating RNA and then reform a DNA, and it just keeps going until you have some weird monstrosity. I would hate to think about the experiments that man has done, because I'm sure they did it with, you know, non-human varieties from animals to insects to fish to whatever birds. But at some point, I think that if any of these laboratories went for any length of time, your sort of reptilian brain scientist is going to have no problem working with human DNA at some point. There have been rumors from folks working in deep clearance locations in the United States of seeing reptilian humans escorted by black suit people. There's actually one that I don't know if it was part of Project Disclosure, but there was a guy, it was a British dude, sitting at a picnic table. I've mentioned this only once before, but he said that on one particular day at this facility, and I can't remember which facility it was. I don't think it was anything that has like a name that we know, like 51 or something like that. But he said he left his office to go to another office. And he said suddenly he found himself in a hallway. It's the hallway everybody uses, the corridor. And there were two black suits on both sides of this reptilian human that was very large. And the dude said, look, I just got a glance at it. But in this particular world that I work in, this is the sky talking, he said, you know, you're not allowed to look where you're not allowed to look. And so as soon as you're surprised seeing something, you want to make sure that you are observed, not observing, so that no one, you know, chases you down. But the dude seemed genuinely freaked out about what he saw. But what was interesting about it is he said, you know, what I thought I saw in that instant of a moment, right? It's that vision worth, 10,000 pages. He said, I just got this sense that it was probably someone having spliced a human being with something else, because this thing didn't seem to have its own mind, meaning it had to be escorted from point A to point B, and it wasn't like, you know, telling a story or moving on its own in a way that we would do. You know, if one of us got escorted by two black suits, you definitely get a sense that this person's alive. But he says, you know, sort of like a dead-eyed being, the sort of the gist of what I got out of it. So, and then there's the conspiracies about governments creating alien-looking beings in order to facilitate this fake alien invasion. And then, of course, you have all the logistics of trying to pull that off, where you might be able to put a bunch of these beings, you know, you raise them, you give them a totally different world of education, totally different world of influence. I mean, you realize, you know, I was making a joke to a friend of mine, you know, you could have a kid, and if you had enough money, maybe it wouldn't even take that much money. I think this happens in various areas of rural America where they don't have a lot of money. But you could raise a child to believe that the world is like it was in 1975. A child doesn't have the right, a child doesn't have the ability just to hop in the car and go somewhere. So if you were to say, okay, just like the Sixth Sense guy that created that one where everyone was back in the past, and I forgot what year it would have been, but it's kind of a Quaker little society, and you found out something about that later. Well, I just have to spoil it for you. They're in the modern age, and somehow, you know, planes didn't fly over and all this other stuff. It's a very fascinating thing. So you would have to raise, or you could raise these kids in a world that looks totally space age. You could tell them they're on a spaceship. You know, you could run the windows. You could say they can't see out for a particular reason. There are no windows. And if you don't know there's something outside, you wouldn't want to see it. And so they could create a language for these beings that's totally different. And you just never know. You could talk to them through a computer. You know, once you get them up to a certain... Now, someone's going to have to take care of them and feed them and get them to the point where they can maintain themselves. They got to eat and clean themselves and learn things. See, someone's going to have to teach them if that was going to be the case. But you could push a bunch of them inside of a vehicle that has, you know, black technology. It's, you know, flying around, looks like a UFO, and then it lands on your street, and then the door opens up, and of course they're going to come popping out, and they're preconditioned perfectly to say everything that you would ever want an alien to say. And then, of course, the locations are automatically known because they're landing these vehicles in various areas, and so they can make a public landing, and then, you know, what looks like normal people coming in to talk to them and get them, you know, taken off somewhere to talk to their leader, our leader. Those are all just actors. And then, boom, you've got the scam. Pretty interesting, right? Be interesting if, like, they, you know, made some mistakes on that day. You know, the vehicle, one of them just flops on the ground. And unfortunately, would probably kill everybody inside. But so, because mankind would do this in 2 seconds if we could, we could travel the universe, if it truly is an open space out there, and if we could find an M-class planet, and especially if we could find an indigenous race of, you know, bipedal beings, that, okay, that's the best thing we have to matching our own DNA, then we could start splicing or start doing what we do. Now, again, if I always recommend everyone go off and listen to Bruce Lipton's book, The Wisdom of Ourselves, because he'll teach you the rest of the creation process of a human cell, especially the chromosome and the protein patterns that dictate the nucleic acid chain combinations. And so in my knowledge and my estimate of how this would be done properly, we would have reached a point where we can, well, first, we have a full catalog of our own protein patterns. We know exactly what makes us tick. There's no protein patterns that would ever travel in the human body that we wouldn't have fully documented. And protein patterns, you know, they come together, and they procreate. That's why, again, you have to eat red meat, because five of the pieces that you need to make healthy proteins is in red meat, and the other three can be gathered through other methodologies. And I've actually heard it up to eight. You know, the eight that you only get from red meat. You can't get it from fish. You can't get it from chicken. And, you know, look at all the dominant species on this planet. You know, you go to the jungle. Who is the ruler of the jungle? The lion or even a tiger? Well, they eat meat, you know. Even the prophesized Tyrannosaurus Rex and all the big dinosaurs are all meat eaters. So everything that eats meat turns into the dominant race, because the brain and the visual cortex grow with meat proteins, especially red meat, of course. And that's how we get, you know, who we are. Now, the other thing too is that you do get aggressive, because you're so sentient with a bigger brain that you sense injustice. And part of Agenda 21's entire objective is to turn everyone into vegetarians, which makes us extremely docile, very unhealthy, etc., etc. So I think that a gene splicing routine would have to do with looking at the differential between the protein patterns in a particular being, and then whatever we want to splice it with. Now, for those of you who haven't, you know, watched any other show, the theory of this missing link, which I don't know about you, and I've never had anyone comment on this, please comment if you can. I was taught the missing link was a very quick little thing, and I didn't really understand what it meant until I researched it. And again, they have approximately 32 different skulls of what they believe to be an evolving hominid, and it doesn't evolve in terms of its brain capacity per capita of the size of the skull. What evolved was that the skulls got bigger. These are really, really old skulls, right? So what's interesting about it is it's somehow bone preserved for this really long period of time. I don't believe they're fossilized. And then there's this huge gap. Now, again, it could be a carbon dating issue or whatever, but we do have, in one fell swoop, with no intermediate skulls, the Homo sapiens skull, the Homo sapien skeleton. That's way, way different. And that Lucy thing was a complete joke, right? They found basically a monkey or a gorilla with a tear-shaped rib cage, which is not Homo sapien, right? We don't have big, giant arms that force our lung capacity and our ribs to go into a tear shape. But that's what all monkeys, all gorillas have, because that's the way they're built. So if you ask an anthropologist, they will tell you that even though you can strip down a gorilla, any form of monkey, and look at their bones, and then look at a human body stripped down, They say there is not a single bone of a human being inside an ape, or vice versa. And so a lot of them quietly reject the theory of evolution without a replacement theory, because they're not, a lot of them are not willing to jump off on creationism as a replacement. And, you know, I respect that, and I don't know what I think, you know. But let me give you an analogy of the engineering of the human skull versus all the hominids that came before, and gorillas and what have you, right? Let's say you had a whistle. A whistle made out of a piece of wood. All it has is a aperture for your mouth and then a hole at the end. There are no little holes to put your fingers in at the top, but you blow on it and it makes a whistling noise through it. And of course, you have to have some sort of valve down by the mouthpiece, of course. It's like a whistle. You might blow like a cop whistle, right? That's about the sophistication of the inside of a hominid skull. All they do is howl, and that's why in the jungle you hear variants of howling. So, you know, you've heard a million different movies have these things in it, but even though a monkey might go, bop, 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 it's still just a howl. They've just created a rhythm to the howl. And of course, you can vary through Doppler's effect and a bunch of other things, the tone of the howl by changing the amount of air you push over your vibrating bits. But the human skull gains this amazing chamber inside the nasal cavity. And our tongue is utterly phenomenal in distinguishing between different languages. I mean, you know, how many rolling R's do we have? How many, you know, there's tribes that have the popping noises in their language, which is, I think, is just so cool. At the same time, the brain capacity of a human being is massive compared to the skull. What does that do for us? Well, it increases our ability to create a denser neural net. Well, the more data you can store, the more that you can sense your surroundings, the more you can think about it. Now, having said that, look at all the insects, look at all the fish with teeny tiny brains, all the little animals out there with teeny tiny brains that manage to live hundreds of years. There, I've recently bumped into this, and I've never heard this as a kid, but they're now finding this. There's a particular shark that I don't believe it's of any danger to man, but this shark lives, I forgot the name of it, but it can't procreate until it's 150 years old. And they found one that they believe is 400 years old. And when you see it, it's huge, and you can actually believe it. So somehow it doesn't have a predator that's easily, you know, endangering its life, and it just roams around. But its brain cavity is still relatively small, especially compared to the size of the being. Now, again, you know, there are, you know, I feel like animals are getting smarter in the world the more that we connect with them empathetically, but you've always had a friend that says, my cat's really smart, my dog's really smart. And man, some of them are. I mean, it's tremendous what they know. And there's insects that act like pets. It's weird. Well, John Cleese and his pet bee, remember that whole thing? So, you know, they'll look at like the size of a dolphin brain. And of course, dolphins do all these wild tricks. They seem to have a little personality in them. And it should be the case, right? Dogs have personalities. Cats have personalities. But when they really measure the areas of the brain that make a dolphin's brain gigantic, it's all the cerebellum, muscle memory to learn how to swim, to do all their tricks, and not necessarily the cognitive frontal lobes that might really help them discern philosophy, you know. We have monkeys that can do, or excuse me, apes that can do sign language. It's interesting. I mean, what an amazing thing. You ever watch that video? I think I mentioned it about 10 episodes ago about Robin Williams saying goodbye to one of the monkeys that was sort of, you know, I forgot her name, because she was kind of, you know, she was kind of ill, and they knew that her lifespan was coming to an end, but, you know, it wants to hug you, and it, you know, there's a bunch of these monkeys, there are a bunch of these gorillas out there that can do this. It's like, it's interesting, right? But the other theory that's very interesting that I just want to throw out there, because I always forget to say this, which is, and I even forgot to say to my evolution 2.0 or whatever it was, there is a question of if evolution is a certainty, then why do we not, like, we don't have prehistoric things still here. Everything evolved up into its next logical thing. We don't have, or we still have monkeys, we still have gorillas, but we're supposedly descendants of them, according to evolutionists, and so why are they still there? They should have all moved up into some humanoid thing if it's some logical thing that starts to occur. And a bunch of them eat meat. Oh my God, I watched videos where chimpanzees were just eating the crap out of Reese's monkeys, eating their own kind. I mean, I watched, it was gross. You know, so the other thing about evolution that doesn't make sense to me is that we have a lot of different human beings, of course, super tiny human beings, big giant human beings. I was at Disneyland, I don't know, 2 months ago, 3 months ago, waiting in line to get some food. And there was this Latin family in front of me. And I'm telling you, there was three women that obviously were related. One of them was the mother. You could tell two of them were sisters / daughters. And they were the tiniest human beings I've ever seen. They weren't dwarfed. They weren't what I was taught as midget, which is a perfectly proportional small person. They were just, they're probably about 4'8", somewhere in there, and proportioned. And it's just wherever they come from, they're tiny people. You know, and I've been at Disneyland. I went on Space Mountain once with these, and some of you guys are going to know this. There's two brothers. They have a Latin last name. Well, they look pretty Caucasian, but they're both 7 feet tall, and they're famous. They were famous college basketball players when I saw them, and I think they've split up into two different teams that are pro now. But I went on Space Mountain with them, which is a roller coaster inside a beautiful enclosure. And I was wondering, like, I'm standing next to these dudes, and their belt was about right up here by my chin. And I was like, damn, these are some tall dudes, man. And they actually fit in the front car, both of them, side by side. And it worked perfectly. They actually had leg room and everything. The bar came over them just fine. I was like, man, that engineering to put two guys in there. I know family members of mine that are too fat to ride the ride because the bar can't click on their belly, right? Very interesting. But why don't we have elves, halflings, dwarfs? You know, why don't we have even an ogre, you know, or an orc? Why don't we have these human beings at all different levels of evolution? And I know some people would speculate that that's the case, but it's not the case. But I mean, we don't have necessarily like physically, mechanically half-evolved human beings. We're all here. Now, some are smarter than others because they have weird governments that repress them, or they just have been living in the jungle. That's different. That's just access to information. But, you know, you find a tribe out there in, was it north of New Zealand? And, you know, I was watching, like I said, I said like 3 or 4 episodes where I was talking about them discovering these tribes in the 80s and 90s. And some of them were black guys, you know, a black tribe, and one of them was a Peruvian tribe. Now, I don't have much reference for Peruvian genetics, but some of the black guys in these tribes that were still undiscovered by man, they look like friends of mine. Some of them look like friends of mine. So that genetic is exactly like the other genetic, but my friends have obviously grown up in modern societies. They're just as amazing as I am. And, you know, but this other tribe is, this other group of humans are fully developed. They're just tribal people, you know? So we don't have that disparaging DNA in us. So I think evolution really falls short of proving itself through the lack of variety in Homo sapiens. How many dogs are there? How many cats are there? I mean, there's just such difference, such a spectrum. How many different bears do we have, you know? Was it the anteater? I mean, I didn't realize there were so many different species of anteaters. We should have that too. And yes, we have some different pigmentation colors, and we have different nose shapes and what have you, but we're really similar. I mean, all of us are pretty damn similar. Just if you were to take any, pick any color you like, and take every human being on Earth, and, you know, for hair and skin colors, change it all to the same. Maybe make it a funny color. And then compare us all across the spectrum. We're damn near exactly the same, you know? So, I think that begs some questions as well. But let's say, at the time of this missing link, you don't have any evolutionary skulls because there weren't any. Hominids would have most likely have been the base DNA / protein patterns that this race would have used. Otherwise, we would look just like them and probably look really, really different. And there's a chance that they just dropped off some of their own people and then all of a sudden we're here, right? But I guess the first question you might ask is why? Why would they do it? Well, I would, you know, being a storyteller myself, I would... Well, the analogy I always use is like, imagine, you know, you do have some, I mean, the simple one is to say that every being is programmed to procreate and hand down their legacy. So there could be just that basic thought process that creates the will to do this. Okay. But if you were, you know, I don't know, what if there's like an alien invasion of some sort, and it's not, you know, it's not good. It's like, what is it, Starship Troopers, where there are insectoids running around, or like Edge of Tomorrow with Tom Cruise, one of my favorite movies. This is something that's definitely not human, and we're fighting it out. But they're winning. They're winning, they're winning, they're winning. And it gets to the point where, just through sheer geography, they have wiped out like every race on Earth except for one race, but you're sort of in that realm. And, you know, the irony in a great movie would be some guy's a racist, right? Let's say he's racist against maybe Chinese people, and China's the last place to get dominated just from sheer luck. And this guy's in there and he's a racist, and he's fighting this out, but he realizes all of a sudden it's all about human against creature. And so he almost like would try to maintain his racism. He's raised with it, whatever his goddamn problem is. But the very last second, they're winning. And this dude dies. And he's going to realize. This is a great story, right? So he looks up at like a Chinese guy who's been treating him well, even though he's been a dick the other way. And he realizes, okay, I'm about to die. And I'm the last of my race, whatever the hell that is. And at least at the last second, he's like, at least humanity won. You know, and so there are all kinds of things that could come into the mind of an alien to make sure their DNA lasts all over the universe. Maybe their planet's getting destroyed or whatever, you know. So I think there's plenty of reasons. Not that anyone's really debating that particular part of the game. But, okay, let's talk about the logistics of it. Okay. Well, if they can do this, that means they got here somehow, which means they have a barrage of ships, some armada of ships that are going to land. And let's just do a little bit of logistics. They'd have to have some facilities to do all their experiments in, place to live. Maybe they're totally monotone, need no entertainment, so that doesn't come or does come. But they need probably an enforcer group of their alien, you know, species to make sure predators don't get them. Maybe they can set up in a way that's not even an issue. Machines take care of it. But then they're going to need time. Even if they're experts, they're going to need time. Now, they could come capture some of our beings, simulate our environment in their world, get it all patented, then drop them off. But I think it'd be easier to work within the environment that these beings would have to live in. And why work with indigenous DNA first? Well, as we all know, anything that can live on a planet is beautifully balanced with nature. So nature's providing food, because before shopping centers and grocery stores, we had to go get our own food. And so, you know, maybe you don't get meat every day because it's really hard to capture. So you can, you know, nuts and berries and fruits and that kind of stuff, vegetables, whatever you're eating to kind of tide yourself over nutrition-wise. And someone kills a wild boar or a bull or some mammoth, and boy, everyone eats for a while. So the beautiful thing is you might actually get a lot of DNA slash protein programming accomplished by the planet itself. You won't have to start from complete scratch. But that depends on their level of sophistication. Now, I mentioned this a couple times this season, but there's the Star Trek episodes where they ask the computer to synthesize the DNA of some piece of evidence they found somewhere. Maybe they get like a fingernail of some material and they put it in the computer and it samples it. And then because the computer understands the cause and effect of protein pattern folding as it relates to nucleic acid creation, it's able to synthesize up and follow all the structural rules of the human body and of life in general. And it's able to create the monster, the person, and show you what it exactly like what the being would look like, say maybe clothing and hairstyle, right? That seems crazy today, but you know, it's not too crazy if you think about quantum computing taking off and then having a few hundred years to do what it does. They could accomplish it. And you know, I'm trying to figure out a way. I've been trying to figure out for a couple years on how to explain what I'm about to attempt to explain here. Probably do it really badly the first time here. But there's all these experiments, there's all these projects in the world to try and figure out pretty much the infinitely complex. You know, Kurzweil with the Singularity Project, trying to figure out the human mind. There's obviously a tremendous amount of experimentation you can do to figure out how synapse fires electricity through the brain, whether or not when you're on cocaine, there's a chemical slash electrical pattern that makes this what it is, right? Because there's a lot of talk about, you know, digitizing the brain and putting it inside of a computer. And of course, it's about like saying we're going to create, Miss Possum's over there, about creating a computer that's going to understand where every particle is in the world such that we can predict weather perfectly. You can't capture all of the particles in the world. At least currently, we don't have any methodology of figuring out where everything is. I mean, there's trillions upon trillions to the power of trillions of things that make up our planet. However, some of you know that, you know, they used to teach artificial intelligence one sentence at a time, one word at a time, breaking down noun, subject, verb, noun, and making it understand, you know, relative morals of this is good, this is bad. When you hear death, it's not good. When you hear birth, it's good. And so nowadays, they just point an AI at the internet and say, read everything you possibly can. We've taught you the basics. You got this kernel. Now we want to see what you can do with that kernel of knowledge. Of course, you know, translating it to every single language out there. And so there's a lot of cause and effect that can occur in a computer's mind. My uncle told me, who was deep into this stuff in the 80s, he told me probably around 84, 85, that the AI that he had been dealing with was capable of basically probability. And so it could read an article and say, okay, a semi-truck is going this direction, a car is going that direction, it's a slippery road, will these two vehicles hit each other? And it would think and go, probably. You know, I mean, that's pretty cool. That's a pretty intense deduction. Again, they're all based on human rules that are put into the code, et cetera, et cetera. But now, when I worked with the folding at home project at Stanford, you know, I was providing graphical stuff for them, so I wasn't doing any research or anything, but I sat there and got a couple good talks with Penja. It's P-A-N-J-E or G-E, the guy that runs the place, because I met him. That's how I got involved. He was just sitting outside eating some lunch or something, and I saw him and I was like, you're that guy, you know, and he liked that. So he was teaching me all about protein patterns within our conversation. It was just all mind-blowing. And then I bumped into Bruce Lipton. I was like, oh my God, the picture's been completed for me. But he was telling me flat out to my face, he goes, protein patterns have been clocked folding faster than the speed of light. So he goes, we don't understand how this is possible. And what they were studying was a protein in its original form, and then protein after it's done its activation, which is, I believe, involves a fold. And so after it's completely folded in its final state, it activates and then starts dictating instructions to the body. Okay. So if we are able to create a device that can take a picture of some sort, a chemical picture, a physical picture that discerns the chemical combinations, the proteins, that the pieces of the protein, and then watch it fold, or at least see it after it's folded, which they do today. There's tons of that data. What they didn't know, which is what folding at home is all about, is trying to figure out exactly how it folds. I mean, it's one of these things, if you had, you know, you had a shoe with its shoelaces untied, and then you see it tied, well, we know there's four or five ways to tie a shoelace. But if that shoelace being tied creates a protein virus like mad cow, the bovine encephali or whatever it is, BSE was right, it, they want to be able to put a finger in there right when you're folding the, tying the knot to prevent it from tying. So they can stop protein viruses from occurring, or maybe make them, who knows, right? But right now they're dumb to any, I should say ignorant, they're ignorant to how the physical composition of a protein pattern of a particular combination would fold as an empirical piece of information, right? So if you had a piece of paper, an 8x10 piece of paper with a seam down the middle, because someone's already done the fold thing, or you just see a piece of paper, and you know that it folds directly in half, well, then you could look at the before and after and probably deduce, well, it looks like someone just folded it in half. And because there's no other creases anywhere in the paper, like an origami experiment, it didn't fold previous to this one fold. And you'd have a rule that pieces of paper, the 8x10, that end up folded in half are going to fold this one way. But if they could extend that knowledge into a quantum computer or use a quantum computer to figure out the probability of folding and then test it and find out you can always block a protein from completing a fold with this algorithm that is 100%, then we could run that algorithm on, let's say we figured it out with four proteins, but it always works. So these rules that are inside this program are so good that now we just run every protein through that piece of software, and it's one for one accurate. And then we have our protein folding rules that then 100% work. Therefore, we have a from to technology to engineer these proteins and thus cause effect. So we get our hominid, we look at its proteins, we look at our proteins, we'd have ourselves completely sequenced, right? The Genome Project was sort of a waste of time. The Genome Project's real objective was to sequence the average DNA of a human being and then allow exotic companies like Amgen to patent strands of our DNA. You can't patent what's in nature. I can't patent a tree. But they're allowing pharmaceutical companies to do this, and it's absolutely insane. It should be unallowed, right? You can't own me. You can't own what makes me. But if you had that program, think about it. You take all the protein patterns of this hominid, just a sample of the tissue, push it through this computer, and the computer could simply generate the program to convert that hominid into us. Just by sheer redesign of the pattern. We could also leave alone patterns that are key to surviving off of the indigenous planet. So we're like, okay, we don't want you to not breathe oxygen. We don't want you to, you know, need a different temperature or something. But they could strengthen the skin, strengthen the bones, re-engineer the bones, and just basically, okay, well, we're not going to, you know, a more efficient body for an intelligent creature, because we are intelligent, we don't need the gigantic arms of a gorilla. But the gorilla doesn't have our brain, so it has to use sheer force to survive. So that's what it does. So I think that for these objectives that seem infinitely impossible, it will be a simple algorithm that is showing amazing promise, amazing accuracy, when, in, you know, compared to the real world, that will start to facilitate these objectives like Kurzweil has. Now, Kurzweil's problem is that there's most likely a soul. And so when you pull a brain into a computer, and remember, you don't have to kill the human being. You just make a copy of it into the computer. It's going to have to rely on an artificial intelligence engine to maintain its thought because the soul's gone. It's still in the human being. So you might be able to, I mean, imagine there's all these services that you can turn your ashes into diamonds. You can turn them into a record, you know, all kinds of stuff, right? These are weird little businesses. But, you know, it's not your relative. It is your relative physically, but it's not going to talk back to you. But imagine you get to a point where you could keep a facsimile of your relative. I mean, whoa. You know, you're like, oh my gosh, I wish I could know what my grandfather would say or my grandmother would say or my father, or my mother. And you have this AI that's doing it. You know, same tone of voice, all that stuff. I mean, wow, right? So a lot of people speculate that perhaps the Egyptians were where these individuals started. And that the theory about the, and it was funny because I did my evolution part two, and I had several of you come in and state something that I should have stated, which was that the theory about the single female in northern Africa being responsible for the sudden surge in Homo sapiens sapien has been debunked big time. Okay. So that's something that is currently the thinking right now. But if you have, I mean, the thing about the Egyptians, it's just wild. So there's pros and there's cons against giving credit to the Egyptians for the sort of gene splicing thing. Obviously, they were capable of rendering anything in stone and rendering anything in painting. So when you see the ancient Egyptian pharaohs, brown, like normal, you know, black people, that's probably what they look like, which means they weren't Arab. They probably bred with other races and eventually lightened their skin such that maybe the last few pharaohs were more of a lighter skin variation. You know, the Ptolemies, which were completely Roman, Cleopatra being a Roman girl, they're all Romans. They're white people running Egypt so that Rome wouldn't roll over the place because the Ptolemies honored the unbelievable accomplishments of the Egyptians. It's really cool. You know, the Rosetta Stone's about the Ptolemies. It's about the Ptolemy the Fourth talking about the death of his father and how there's going to be revenge. And always remember about the Rosetta Stone, there should be dozens and dozens of Rosetta Stones down the Nile because the Rosetta Stone says that it is a message that's being posted at a port down the Nile such that when you trade up the Nile, you heard about the news. So there should be a lot of them. I don't know why we haven't found another one. It's just weird. How do you get rid of a big black rock, you know, written in three different languages? You know, and I know that I've only heard it once, but I know there's a few folks that think that the pyramids were built in the 1800s, which blows the mind. Okay. Okay, it's 2019. How do they do it? Because we can't do it today, right? But one of the things you can do with Egyptians is look at their understanding of the stars is ridiculous. The pyramids in the Giza Plateau are amazingly aligned with the equator, with due north. I mean, it's like this wild compass to the world. But if you look at their burial rituals, and it's always good to remember what they write in stone, what any society writes down is what they believe to be one of the most important things to write down. And so they had burial rituals which believed, you know, that there was an imperative that you keep your body intact for as long as possible. Because you're going to go, you know, Pharaoh would go hunting in the afterlife. And so there's a lot of, you know, all the tombs in the Valley of the Kings have all this decorative painting and all their stuff is, you know, dropped in rooms with them. King Tut's, you know, multiple chambered tomb has everything an 18-year-old kid would need in the afterlife, which, you know, he's a grown adult in their mind at that time. You know, it was actually the case in America up till about, I don't know, 1990. So think about it. if you were some interstellar race, why would you believe in such things as keeping your body preserved? Why would you think that you're going to stay on Earth and hunt? It's sort of a romantic, albeit primitive, way of looking at the afterlife. At least we think, you know. It's interesting how, you know, there's something I don't talk about because there's no real place to put it, but, you know, we have human beings that like being cremated and human beings that like being put in caskets, keep their body there. And it's interesting because I've vacillated with that myself. Most of my family is evolving to cremation. For whatever reason, I personally like visiting a grave, and it's some people think that's really morbid, but you know, it's a peaceful, wonderful thing for me personally to go to my grandparents' graves, and it's just this beautiful field in Kansas. I mean, I'm in like a little slice of heaven in there on a summer day, and just having a conversation, just knowing they're right there. That body that they used to use is right there. I don't think their soul's down there. I don't believe anything the Bible says about holding your soul down into your body, and then you get, you know, resurrected on Judgment Day, which was always really kind of weird for me and disturbing to think about. Like, really? They're down there going, the old saying that people roll around their grave when their contributions to the world are undone. But now, so logistically speaking, let's say they get the Homo sapien worked out. It's time to deploy. Well, there's one theory that they would have it so locked down because they have interstellar travel or even interdimensional travel that there wouldn't really be a need for testing things. It's like Tesla. You just think about it. Think about the machine for 2 years, age the ball bearings in your mind, which is what he did, and everything he built worked the first day. And he's just known for that. He's just this crazy, brilliant human being, right? Which, you know, I think there's a lot of, just to break for 1 second on that, you know, Tesla lived to be 85 years old, which is a good life for anyone in his timetable because he was in the more rustic version of America at the time, right? Limited medicine and all that stuff. They really accentuate the fact that he died penniless, like he's somehow a failure. I don't think he died penniless, you know? I think that if that dude ever needed money, he'd just go get it. I think he died with what a man needs at 85. I think that's really what it comes down to. You know, again, I'm reading a book right now by him that he wrote in 1919. I need to get back to it because I got really into it and then I got sidetracked. So I maybe don't believe that so much. You know, I think that's part of the banker's epitaph on him to say what a failure that guy was or look how we dominated him. And let's not give him that win. I don't believe that's true. Again, a guy, it's interesting because a lot of people at 85, they don't have like an amazing contributional value to society because all the things that they use to get their life, you know, to move forward decade to decade has been deprecated, right? But that dude died with more knowledge in his brain than anyone on planet Earth. I mean, that's not even an exaggeration. He was one of the first founders of wireless technology, and we barely had it in use when he died, right? And now we live off of it, you know, what is it, 70 years later? So the dude, he could have gotten money if he wanted it. I don't think he died penniless. But they also show you his body, you know, his last photographs of him being really old. And they're, see, look how old and pathetic he looked. And it's like, dude, it's just being old. You know, relax. Let's see how good you look at 85, right? But so they deploy human beings on Earth. But there's a lot of indigenous problems because, again, an infant child is very, very vulnerable. I mean, how long does it take before you personally with your child would just let them roam around the forest by themselves? I'd say 16 to 18 and they'd probably know how to shoot a gun and they'd have one. You know, it's not going to be because they'll just get eaten alive by whatever's out there. You get a whole pack of wolves that just tear you apart. You get one bear, you're dead. You know, I mean, it's just a wild boar pokey and kill you, right? So it's not, like we need assistance kind of getting going. But now, let's say that this event actually occurs and they actually did land a bunch of ships here, like a Star Trek episode. They do whatever it takes. Maybe they're here 100 years, maybe they're here 1,000 years, maybe they're here 10,000 years. Who knows, right? I don't think they'd have to stay that long, but at some point, if man was doing this, we wouldn't leave behind all of our tech to confuse them. We would probably teach them how to build, teach them some mathematics of building, whether it be something in spoken language or something in just know-how, right? There's people that understood pi before they understood that there was a number that's infinite, you know, 3.14, blah, 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 right? And so, you know, the pyramids are based on pi. All of the sculptures they did of their faces are all super pi-based. So there was massive knowledge about mathematics without maybe totally discerning it in language. Maybe they did, maybe they didn't. I've studied, you know, thousands of hieroglyphs, and I don't see anything talking about mathematic education. And isn't that fascinating? Why is there a debate about how the pyramids were built? Because there's no schematics of how they were built. Really? I mean, how many things do we build in this world where we have no schematics left over? Like none. And we didn't write things in stone. They wrote everything in stone. Okay. Why wouldn't someone lay it out somewhere? Like in some secret temple somewhere where it's like, okay, you're not allowed in here unless you're one of the engineers of pyramids because we don't want our enemies to know how we build these things. But eventually they boil off through invasion or whatever, and it's still there and someone can read it. We don't find any of that stuff. Now, a bunch of you know that there's a ton of stuff that's still being hidden in Egypt. The percentage of things hidden in Egypt is widely speculated, but it's probably safe to say that without exaggeration, the lowest number I could imagine would probably be about 70% of everything is still under sand. But there are some folks in Egypt that say, that are Egyptian, that say, look, 90% of stuff is all under sand. You're not allowed to go because it's going to reveal where we truly came from, who was really in charge. And I really think it's just a race battle, in my opinion. They just can't give it up to anyone other than the Arabs at this point, because they own the land now, and they've lived there now for thousands and thousands of years. And so, you know, they take all credit for all things down there. So I think logistically speaking, we ourselves would set up our new species with enough knowledge to survive, to build a shelter, to hunt, and to probably hunt something that is optimal for us, right? So the, you know, I don't know how they came up with this, the anthropologists, but, you know, I grew up believing that they absolutely knew that Homo sapiens sapien hunted mammoth elephants. And so, of course, you know, think about these things, you know, I don't have any problem believing that mammoths exist. It's just a larger species of an elephant. But that's a lot of meat, right? So you kill one of these things and, you know, they're super powerful, but, you know, with like 50 guys with spears, you could poke that thing to death so it bleeds out and harvest it, and then you could feed a ton of people. So, you know, I don't know what was indigenous to Egypt at the time. I'm not sure anyone really does, because it was definitely more lush at one point. There's a lot of evidence that the Nile itself has been, it's naturally moved several miles, I think, to the east. It could have been a natural thing, could have been man-made irrigation mechanisms, who knows? So I'm not sure we really understand what was there. We can speculate, you know, but the desert's an unforgiving entity, and you're not going to find, like, we might find bones buried in one place in the world because the soil is of the nature to fossilize something or to preserve it. You know, like, we've had some amazing finds in Asia with the, that baby woolly mammoth, you know, amazing. So we're going to set these guys up, and the information that we give them would be very tempered, wouldn't it? It'd be restricted. We don't want to give them, you know, warp capability on the first day. We don't want to give them anything that they can't have access to immediately after whatever we give them has expired, right? So you wouldn't train them, for instance, like, I'll give you a stupid example. We wouldn't feed these individuals pizza, because they don't know how to make it. And so here they are thinking the pizza is the only food that they can possibly eat. And now they can't make it because they don't know how to grind up wheat and put all this, you know, get milk out of or cheese out of milk and all this other stuff. But maybe we do teach them some very basic things to get them and just study the resources on the planet and go, okay, well, we got this. And it's probably all part of the evaluation process if this were to ever occur. And maybe we even bring seeds and we say, okay, well, we're going to drop this seed all over the planet so that it grows in all the continents so that when they finally reach these places, there's apples and berries and nuts and whatever they need. And because we've given them innate capabilities to hunt, kill, you know, cut it up, turn it into beef jerky, whatever it is, we know that wherever they are, they're going to be able to survive. But I think that there's enough sort of non-alien primitive beliefs that I fully respect. But, you know, preserving your body in order to live in the afterlife, I'm not convinced, okay? What do you mean everyone who's cremated doesn't have an afterlife? I don't believe that for a second. But they're going to have to pick up all their stuff and get out of here. And so, you know, what's interesting is they have the plateaus that are in, you know, in Cairo / near the Giza Plateau. And imagine the plateau is, as far as we know, the plateau and the pyramids themselves were the power supply for the aliens themselves. You know, I mean, you know, it was like, oh, let's just put this together. We got spaceships and stuff. We'll just cut these rocks out, put them up there. Now, there's really no evidence of such a thing. But they kept speculating that the plateaus in Egypt were runways for, you know, like biplane aliens or whatever, right? They need to really have a big runway. But maybe it's literally the place where they set everything down to do all their work. And because it's stone, it lasts forever. So imagine that the theory is actually correct, but the interpretation of how it would be used is all incorrect. That they're actually just landing pads, you know. I have to say, some of you will have immediately thought of Stargate when I said that stuff. I thought that the idea that the pyramids were kickstands, essentially landing pads for a spaceship with some sort of, you know, pyramid underbelly is very fascinating, because what would be the point of that, right? Because a pyramid is actually an extremely bad use of space when you talk about living in it. So it's obviously doesn't have any rooms in it besides the few chambers that are in there. It's not really meant to have a lot of folks in there, right? But a pyramid shape is actually very interesting in terms of distributing stress on the ground. And so if you were to, you know, land a spaceship on top of a pyramid, which I thought was probably one of the most clever things in the entire script, minus the actual Stargate reconstruction and use, yeah, you maybe land some gigantic, I don't know, few million ton vehicle on that thing, and it's just, you know, you just put one down. You know, I think that it would be, they're built so close together that landing several of them would make no sense, because the upper part would probably bang into one of the other ones, right? It's a romantic theory. I think it's kind of fun. And remember, anyone who tells you that they know what Pharaoh built the pyramids is full of shit. Okay, you just got to know that. They have the two things that I read about was that you have handwritten painting way inside the thing that says that this Pharaoh built this. Then you have a keystone that is a cornerstone, basically, that is pulled out, and it supposedly had, you know, carved in the top who built this particular pyramid. But because they have a legacy of one pharaoh gets rid of the other pharaoh's stuff, you could shave the top of that thing off, put the other guy's name in, push it back in, and just keep that process going. You know, and they're pretty good stonemen, so maybe you can put a brand new stone in there. You pull the other one out, toss it, and then you destroy it, and then you put the new one in. Whatever. So then, they've deployed it. They've deployed the Homo sapiens sapien. We start to flourish. They're probably going to watch it for several decades, if not a few centuries, to make sure it takes off. Now, maybe if we just, because there's a few threats that could still mess with humanity. One, predators modify their attack to overcome whatever lessons were taught to the Homo sapiens sapiens, so you need to reprogram to be more tough. It could be that we procreate way too quickly, and you have like the several theories we have for various races around the world that ate all their food and then died out. You know, there's a bunch of theories about the original Incas doing that exact thing. Don't know. But they get us going. They're imbuing us with information, us being, you know, the humans. And, you know, again, there's, according to Graham Hancock and a photograph that he shared with Joe Rogan, which ran on an episode during one of the interviews that I saw. And what's weird is what I'm about to say, I've said it several times, but I have to clarify, in all my studying of hieroglyphs, which is basically ancient Arabic with no vowels, I didn't see these two symbols ever referenced in any of my materials. And these books were from about 1910 to 1950, when it was very in vogue to do Egyptian research. But the symbol for year was a circle that was full, which means the sun. And the circle and the symbol for month was a circle that was empty on the inside, really referencing Earth. Because you could look at Earth and you can't look at the sun because it's too bright, right? So it seemed like, according to Graham Hancock, who to this day I still respect him very, very much, it looks like they had full knowledge of the stars and the planet. But then how could they? How could they know that? Well, it could be that they had a Copernicus and a Galileo dude eventually born in their, you know, evolutionary track, and someone just utterly figured it out and said, I think this is the way it works. Well, we need a symbol for one of these two. So for each one of these, you know, durations, so let's just whatever, let's just take your theory. It works good. Or because we were dropped off, we were engineered and then dropped off, our creators, if you will, told us that that's the way it was. But then other theories, that theory starts to boil off as that indigenous race with all that knowledge gets spread out and, you know, killed, and so we lose it. And then we come up with flat Earth. Could be. And again, according to David Icke, can't believe I'm about to say this, he said that the word Zulu means people from space. That's what they believe the translation means. All right, that's fascinating. Any of you have seen the Mayan artwork? It is, you know, again, like I've told you, I think hieroglyphs are some of the most beautiful symbols that man has ever created, and especially the way that they wrote for beauty and not for phonetic organization of the words. So again, if you've missed all my other episodes, what the Egyptians did was they would take your name. Let's say your name was Benjamin. It's a nice, big long name, lots of letters. They would organize your consonants in a way that looked most beautiful. And usually in a little square, you know, you'd stack it up in little squares. And so you would have in one particular use of your name, or usually names are in cartouches, but whatever, we're talking about a watermelon, right? In one realm, they might write watermelon in one configuration because it's most beautiful when, say, reading from right to left, as they did. But they also wrote them left to right. It didn't matter. Whichever way that the symbol in a hieroglyph is facing is the way you read into it, which is cool. But they did door jams all the time, and that's where you get some of the most beautiful configurations of some of their symbols. And again, I'll remind you, there's the little trick you've seen out there where there'll be a paragraph and some meme out there where all of the words in a paragraph have been, all the letters in words have been scrambled, except the first and the last letters are correct. And your brain can totally read it just like a fluent book. And that's because I think at the very beginning of our phonetic development, when we moved out of iconic languages where every symbol was a word, when we started doing phonetic language, which was the Egyptians, that's the way we did it for thousands and thousands of years. So we still have that programming in our mind to decipher instantaneously. It's very fascinating, and no one ever talks about it. It's so bizarre how you got producers at, you know, Sci-Fi Channel, Discovery Channel, trying to come up with a new hook for something, and they really just need to watch Deep Thoughts, isn't that right? Now, in terms of, there's a couple more questions, obviously there's a million other questions, but there's a few more that I'm going to address here. And one of them is the fascination that we have a few things that happen. We have people of all different races on Earth. Extremely distinctly different colors that we have in our skin pigment. And again, like I said before, we do have noses that are different, ears that are different. Some races are built to be very skinny, and other races are built to be really big. Like your Samoan races are usually, you know, bigger people. And every single place we've ever gone on Earth, including Easter Island of all things and Hawaii, someone has been able to migrate there, or there's this indigenous race there that's been there for seemingly forever. Now, the evolutionary way to explain that would be man, like it would be Magellan was the only, he was like the last famous white guy to do it, right? But it looks like everybody was the Magellan, if you believe in evolution. Everyone just got on a boat and just went one island to the next, to the next. If they could see land, they'd go in that direction. After a while, they started trusting themselves, building bigger boats that could go deep sea, or at least, you know, deep ocean surface penetration. You know, the theory of, or the story of Kamehameha finding, I don't think he was the guy that actually found it, but it's the whole story that makes Hawaii possible. Man, Hawaii is out in the middle of nowhere. And I mean nowhere. And they not only discovered that island, a band of islands, but they were able to balance their consumption of food at the island such that they didn't go extinct. Amazing. How do you even send a message back, right? You're going to get back on that boat? Hell no, man. Once you get to this island in the middle of nowhere, you're in paradise, you know. You invent gin. Rum. Sorry, you invent rum. You make a bunch of cool drinks. You invent the ukulele. And then, man, you're set. Get a little grass skirt and you're good. Easter Island's way out in the middle of nowhere. Not only did they discover the place, but they built all these wild statues that they face in very specific directions. We recently found out all these statues actually have legs. We kept thinking they were just heads. Still trying to figure out how they made them, how they, because they look a little primitive. So we're able to stomach the idea that chisel and rock would have made them, rock against rock or whatever. Still phenomenal. You know, I look at the Asian race. I mean, it's a phenomenal difference in, you know, Japanese and Chinese and Vietnamese and Korean. It's a very distinct, amazing, different look. I mean, isn't this great that we have all these different human beings? This idea that we're all supposed to be this gray, centralized, one human race. It's just, it makes me gag. It's like, no, man, I like differences. I like meeting people from different parts of the world. Indians and Russians and, you know, everybody, Africans, everybody, Arabs. It makes the world fun. We're a pattern ingesting being. If we were to do the globalist plans for the world and we lose all of our nation, you know, borders and stuff, and so it's, you know, borders are, you know, walls are unfortunate, right? But saying, well, you're in Germany now. Hey, have yourself a knockwurst and a beer. And then you go to, you know, Mexico and you're like, here's the taco and here's this, you know, amazing cooked corn and stuff. Man, do you want to lose all that? I think it would suck, you know? So, but it looks like maybe, as part of a more logical theory, that after creating us, they dropped us everywhere where we could survive. Maybe even not through evolution, because black people will have albino babies, and they have blue eyes. And I guess every black kid has blue eyes for a certain period of time, and then they change colors. But, you know, there's theories that white people popped out of black folks. Okay. Black people can have babies. If black people have babies forever, they eventually pop out of an albino. White people have babies forever. They never pop out a black person. So there's a little bit of a theory there. Some racists have a huge problem with that, but get over it. But you have Aborigines, you know. We do have the Native Americans, which are, I think, distinctly different than your sort of South American Latin races. And even in South America, the Peruvians look completely different than the Brazilians. You know, there's a lot of mix-up. You can see where people having sex probably churned out, you know, a hybrid race. You know, I was always told that the Native Mexican race is a bunch of Spanish conquistadors coming over and breeding with everybody who was here, and that's where the Mexican race came from. That's what I've been told. It's believable. Whatever. They both speak Spanish, right? So for me, it's not a stretch. It's not a stretch at all. Anytime someone has a problem with something that man would do, I think I laugh inside. It's like, really? We would do that in a split second. You know, maybe we would have some sort of prime directive like Star Trek has, where if you do find a fully functional, intelligent race, then we don't touch it. We observe. But after they drop us off, wouldn't they come back to check? To see how the experiment's going? I could understand a theory where they wouldn't do that, because they're just too busy. They're out there going, well, there's a limited amount of us, especially the special, you know, crack team that can do this. But maybe, you know, the crack team goes off and keeps putting the DNA all around the universe, whereas this other anthropological team from the other group comes in and watches, and that's where you get UFO sightings. You know, UFOs definitely fall in at least two categories, if you want to put them in that. You have ships that are so large that you could understand that there would be a bunch of people in them, or a bunch of beings in them. And then ships that are so teeny tiny are like, well, maybe, but they'd be really tiny people, you know. That's why I think it's funny when they try to, you know, zoom in on a UFO and you see like a gray alien inside. I mean, there was one that was recently done. It was so pathetic. I mean, it was so pathetic, these hoax they were trying to push off on everybody. But again, the game Spores, created by Will Wright for EA, formerly Maxis, he did that exact thing in his video game. You handled a single cell creature all the way up to being a sentient, you know, bipedal. You could make it any way you want. You could have like six or seven legs if you want, but it was like a humanoid level intelligent being. And again, for evolution, we should have all kinds of speaking beings. Like, of, you know, human DNA should have gone in all different directions. You know, this ape thing should have gone in all different directions, where maybe you have a guy with four arms, you know. There should be a race like that. You know, think if you had two extra arms, wouldn't you dominate the whole planet? You know, you just have four six-shooters, you know, instead of two. We don't see any of that. But what he did in the game was that you would see UFOs every once in a while observing your world. And what really was going on is those UFOs were administrators at EA looking at your world, trying to see if you came up with something cool that they would then take a picture of and then feature you in some website for the game. I thought that was brilliant. It was like I had, you know, I think we all have that thought of like UFOs could be them observing us. Of course, what else could you think? They don't land. They don't come out and say hi. But to repeat that so beautifully in the video game, I thought was a stroke of absolute genius. So let me know what you think about this whole thing. If you haven't done the deep dive in this, definitely look up, you know, anthropologists. I think you'll have more fun probably in the first run looking up the ones that talk about the missing link as it relates to Bigfoot. You know, In my opinion, I disintegrated Bigfoot. I think it's episode 201. 2000, oh my God. 201. We're open with Bigfoot for season 2. Just go see that. I won't repeat any of that here. But definitely let me know what you've run into. And I would be really, really interested. I don't think I have any anthropologists watching. But if you know one, it'd be interesting to have a sit-down conversation with someone that actually has seen this stuff forever. And you have to brace yourself because they'll be extremely indoctrinated, you know, by whatever they're told. And, you know, that what's funny is, of course, is that everything that we're told tends to shift. You know, you have one theory 1 year and then another theory, you know, 10 years later. Unfortunately, since science is now officially a religion, we have been so stagnant in our development in science. It's really bad, and it's only really the folks that are making YouTube channels and really spreading information, because they can't find like-minded people in their universities, because it's, you're not even allowed to talk against the doctrine, against the dogma. And so we have to rely on each other to kind of spread this information. I just saw that meme again. Well, it's not really a meme, but it's a picture. And I think it's even related to an article that I see it. I used to see it a lot a couple of years ago. And it's this article that basically says that they want to, I think quite literally is the insinuation in this article, genocide every single human being on Earth that doesn't believe the current theories about everything. So, for instance, if you've come to the conclusion that the Big Bang is a bunch of bullshit, dark matter's bullshit, black holes are bullshit, all that stuff is just not true, then you, by these idiots that don't know anything about what they're talking about, these are just citizens that want to promote an article to say, I'm promoting this article to kill everybody on Earth that doesn't believe what I don't even understand, and that'll make me smart. You know, it's like the guy who can't read buys a bunch of books, never reads them. You know, hopefully the guy will start reading at some point. But I think that's obviously massively dangerous. It is going to put us in a stunted growth pattern, and it's obviously a piece of propaganda that could relate to Agenda 21. Who knows? But they want to say, essentially say, man in 2019 has figured out everything. Despite when you drill into these theories, there's big question marks all over the place. Bunch of, you know, frog DNA put inside the dinosaur DNA. It doesn't work. And I think that we have to fight back. I think we have to fight back. And I posted my friend's post. I can't remember who even posted it. You know, I said, I'm ready for the public debate. You just let me know where everybody shows up and I will eat them alive in front of everybody. But I get to bring my computer and bring my slideshow to prove that lies are everywhere, right? And those a lot of flat earthers would love that debate. Now, there's a romantic side of this argument, which is if we are descendants of some supreme, you know, Prometheus race, then we have within us potential brilliance that we don't use on a daily basis until we keep cracking our brain open. Hopefully deep thoughts help stimulate those dormant genes in your mind. And again, the anthropologist that broke down the visual cortex said there's 5 slices of your visual cortex, but there's protein blockers in there to limit us to use 1/2 of one slice, meaning we don't use, but 10% of our visual cortex? Well, what's going to happen if we see the other 90% of the visual spectrum? Do we start seeing them? Do we start seeing the UFOs everywhere? Do we see them walking around us? Who knows? How the hell did that get there? Why would evolution ever create that? That was a tuning fork for the eyeballs. I don't know. We should have, well, considering that that humanity in general, the Homo sapiens sapien, is driven by curiosity. We just think when we, what we think fuels flat Earth. It's a speculation that it could be true. And then what does that mean? You know, anyone is a ufologist. There's a curiosity there because most of us have never met one. We've never seen one land. So what, we've got other people's evidence to tell us that these things really occur. All right. So I think that genetically speaking, our predisposition would be to be enlightened to the absolute maximum apex of our brain. And the visual cortex would be probably one of the most powerful senses that we could develop so that we could see more. I think that's all I got on that. Let me know what you think. If you haven't been to deepthoughtsradio.com, please go. Make it a short bumper today. There's plenty of links for video. Get yourself a bitchute.com account, because YouTube might start pulling some shenanigans on December 10th. There's plenty of podcast links for you. There's plenty of social media for you. There's plenty of ways to donate to the show. And understand that season 1 is no longer on this channel. So there's a link up there for the all-new remastered season 1. Please subscribe, and just when you get through all 100 and whatever episodes I did on that channel, just you can unsubscribe and walk off. It's non-monetized because they changed all the requirements for monetizing a channel to be some damn near impossible feat to accomplish without some viral punch to one of your videos, so my stuff is not going to pop over there anytime soon. Anyway, until the next episode, take care of yourself and someone else, and I'll see you in the next Deep Thoughts. Over now.